Okay. Welcome back to the No Name International series of No Name Podcast. Today, we are having a guest, and with me today contributing to the recording is Andrei Varusha and Alexei Starov. And we are having here a friend from Poland, Kamil Boyarski, who is quite a prominent figure in the Polish cybersecurity industry. Together, he is giving a talk at, I guess, largest at the moment Polish cybersecurity professional event. I know him from contributing to various international conferences at different capacities. I'm happy to observe his trajectory through last couple of years, mostly because he reminds me of myself, like slightly younger, more handsome, with a little bit more hair version of me. So yeah, I'm like looking in the mirror. Okay, Camille, welcome.
Welcome, welcome. And yeah, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. I've got to admit, I'm not following your podcast like episode by episode, but I did hear about it. And I remember listening, for example, to talk with late Ross Anderson. I guess a few months after he passed away, I looked up this podcast. Yeah, and when I saw the list of the guests you're having, like just from the first YouTube page. Halvar Flake was the last guest, and earlier Max Smith, Bruce Schneier, Ross Anderson. So I'm quite intimidated. I will be able to be at least half as interesting as the guests you're having. The expectations are through
Oh,
the roof.
I bet you
So
will. I bet you
thank you
will.
very much
Please.
for having me here. It's a pleasure and
Of
honor.
course. Thank you for joining us. So yeah, could you please just for the starters tell everyone in the audience, to our listeners and viewers, what's your pathway, what's your background, and what you are focused at right now?
Sure. So my name is Kamil. I'm currently working as a threat intelligence lead for South Asia and Middle East in one of the global financial organization. Before that, I was working in various capacities related to threat intelligence, threat hunting, incident response, and security operations across bigger and smaller companies. My path to cybersecurity is not that usual or depends. I guess I don't have technical background like the academic university background. I've got a law degree actually, but even during my law studies, law school, I kind of started veering towards cybersecurity from this policy aspects. I was really interested in how the field is developing. Obviously, there was a lot going on in terms of technical security practice, and I saw that legal aspects, policy aspects are catching up. So I found it quite fascinating to follow that path. But because of various market conditions and opportunities that were available, I joined an IT company, basically, where I started as a first line security operations center analyst to kind of kickstart my career. But I quite quickly became interested in the threat intelligence aspect. And I was very lucky because at the time the threat intelligence function at the company was still developing. I mean, they had a threat intelligence team, but the direction was not so clear. They were looking into expand, and I kind of jumped into opportunity to develop this service. So I had this opportunity working in a big multinational organization that had some visibility and already very mature incident response product process. It was managed service provider, but and I could on that start learning and building at the same time the threat intelligence function to build capabilities. Again, because it was managed service provider, there was internal and external aspect of this work. Yeah, and that's how it goes. Similarly, it went with the threat hunting function, which was again being developed at the time, and I could contribute to how service was working. And I quickly kind of then realized that the threat intelligence, threat hunting aspects are what kind of drives me, what's most interesting to me. in this in the cybersecurity field, like being able to understand what the adversaries are doing, having this pronounced knowledge, because like working in incident response security operation, it was very nice from the learning perspective, from the technical perspective, but I constantly like asking myself like we've got those detections, we've got those threat hunting techniques, but how do we know we are actually addressing the correct stuff? How to hunt adversaries and how to know that we are hunting correct stuff. So having this deep understanding. Of course, I will just make a quick like usual disclaimer that here I'm speaking only in personal capacity, not representing official position of my current employer or previous organization I work on or any other organization I'm affiliated in. But yeah, but this was very valuable experience being able to set up those services. And then I work for another bigger company. Then I work for a startup. And now currently I'm at this global financial organization. At the same time, as I'm in technical roles, I was driven towards those policy aspects stemming from my low background, but also seeing that I quite quickly realized that often perhaps technical people, cybersecurity people are putting too much faith, too much expectations regarding just the technical defense, like this notion that we can, let's say, out defend our way out of everything from the cyber defense perspective. I don't think it's accurate when we are dealing with state operated groups and just basically state on state actions. So yeah, so I try to also develop in this direction. I was a Virtual Roots Fellow, so European Cybersecurity Fellow, and just finished the fellowship in April this year. And this was very valuable experience being able to work with other fellows, with Max Smith, James Shires, who are setting up the virtual roots and developing it. And having this bridge between how the technical stuff work, how the policy can be implemented. And also, yeah, I'd like to, as Vlad was mentioning, I'm speaking at some conference. I like to share and I like to exchange ideas because I'm quite aware how that I'm only seeing a small picture most of the time, even in terms of the threat activity that I'm focusing on. There is always more to uncover. So yeah, I try to speak at conference. I'm also from time to time teaching assistant for the SANS 4578, and I find this very, very valuable venue, not just to teach new folks, but also to learn something from the various backgrounds that they represent, the students who are taking the course and have the have this shared experience or just exchange ideas on how in different institutions, in different environments, threat intelligence works from the government to private sector, from smaller to bigger companies and so on. Yes, so basically I think this is my short introduction. I'm, as you can probably tell, the flair is in threat intelligence and I think this is also what allowed me to combine those perspectives from the technical analysis to some bigger picture strategic operational view on what is going on there.
Regarding the disclaimers, I will second him. Yeah, I will save time and not repeat
Sure,
what he just said. Okay,
Cool.
so yeah, it's a fascinating pathway. I'm not surprised when people with law degrees are getting into security or with social sciences degrees, because basically, yeah, that's also a perspective, that's a facet, and that's a perfectly legitimate way to enter the industry. However, that when you described how you transitioned from incident response to threat hunting, I wanted to interrupt you and congratulate you with this decision, because like the earlier in your career you were like you're leaving this reactive approach, this mindset of like following the detections and actually embrace the proactive, like active anticipation mentality, the better. The more productive your cybersecurity career will be, I guess, because I'm coming from like the red team side of it, so probably that's not what proactivity, that's not what we lack from the very beginning. But like seeing how the industry, how blue teamers are stuck in this detection engineering and then trying to recreate what actually happened, not basically not having a stake in the game from the very beginning, right? Just from the middle of it.
Yes,
That's
when I was starting, actually the incident response, the security operation was kind of the default job, and I think for the very right reason. And when we look at the history of cybersecurity, when we go back to Mandiant and how it was incident response company very much and so on, yeah, I
Of
mean
course,
it.
naturally, we need much more incident responders than threat
No,
hunters.
of course,
That's
but just
of course.
what I wanted to say, one sentence is that when I was joining, I felt like there is this mountain of incident response going on, and now was the time to, take the shovel and start putting it on the other heap of proactive, like hunting, detection, like use the knowledge that we have to translate it
Why?
into understanding
Quite
of
justifiably
adversaries.
so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would also like to add on this transition between like threat hunting and threat intelligence. I think like for me as a blue teamer a bit more, it's also interesting, right? Because from my experience, different people can understand differently, like what is threat intelligence, what is threat hunting. There is also proactive threat hunting and so on and so forth. So what is kind of your vision? What is healthy? And especially maybe for companies as well, what is a healthy combination of threat hunting, threat intelligence, and maybe give some examples like what
So that's a great question, and yeah, I see it. I think Robert Emley of Dragos and also SARS 4578 had this idea. I think it was supposed to be his PhD thesis. Not sure if he finished it, but he had this sliding scale of cybersecurity investments, basically. So starting from the architecture and like the basic controls, having the hygiene, and ending up at offensive operations. And the threat hunting intelligence was more to the, let's say, right-hand side, so on the more mature level of organization. And I mean, yeah, let's start with, I tend to agree with that, because I also seen in many, many cases, especially back there at the beginning of the career, when threat hunting became a bit of a buzzword, a new trend, a new thing to do. A bit like AI, maybe this day, that we are starting threat hunting program, like chop chop, let's do the magic. And there was little visibility into process execution or network security monitoring and so on. So I see still cyber threat intelligence, threat hunting as rather mature functions, meaning that they need a very significant, let's say, basis fundamentals of incident response, of security operation, and so on. If you have good architecture, if you've got good incident response security operation capabilities, then by all means, like this proactive approach, analysis of adversarial activity, tracking groups that are relevant to you, probably especially, and then turning those into detection, like hunting hypothesis and so on, is a way to go. But yeah, but in terms of healthy relationships between functions, definitely not putting a cart before the horse. And again, having an intelligence capability when you don't have apologies, having this intelligence capability when you don't have enough information to start producing intelligence, to start actually cataloging tracking groups in any way that will not be derived only from open sources, might not have so great return on investments for the company. And especially when we are talking intelligence about some state activities, intelligence on those well-established ransomware groups, you have to be realistic about how much you can actually add to the feeds, to the products you can buy. Because if you've got companies that are providing threat intelligence and they are sitting on top on the pile of incident response that they are doing every day and can actually provide you with meaningful conclusions, with meaningful observation about what they are seeing, like you're usually not going to outpace the just the volume and the quality of those feed, especially if you're a smaller company, if you don't have much footprint. Apologies, my throat is a bit itchy. If you don't have this kind of visibility, I mean, if you are if your company is being attacked every day and you are doing this kind of observation every day, then sure enough, I would say go ahead and start producing, maybe even, selling or sharing intelligence. But you have to be realistic about what are your options in terms of generating versus just ingesting and consuming. And for threat hunting, this is a bit different because you can derive hypotheses from perhaps open source reports like the farreport.com and then stuff like this. And you can start testing how your environment is working, what you are seeing, perhaps even seen unseen activity because you are putting resources into those manual detection engineering. But yeah, but intelligence is hard, I would say, from this perspective.
Yeah, I wanted to chime in. Because when you said you have to be realistic what you can add to your threat intelligence, I guess most of the at least commercial sector blue teamers would really consume threat intelligence produced, right? Not produce their own. And you're absolutely right that most of the companies will be, well, if they have this practice, it will be a consumer. But I wanted to factor in also because your page is you have the domain counterintelligence, which is even one step further, right? And especially here, this word sounds more like state-oriented and more offensive because counterintelligence in classic warfare, I guess it's very offensive thing, right? Because you actually plant your own spies in the response, and then you attack wherever you can, preventing basically attack on you. And also, it's state, I mean, flavored thing, but you always worked in the commercial sector, and I think there's somewhere the statement, either on your page or maybe in some of your talks, I don't remember, that nowadays it's this luxury that you can actually be in some state-like activity, but in the private sector. So yeah, if you can factor in your thoughts on how you see counterintelligence, how you would define it, where it's applicable, and so on.
Yeah, sure. So that's a great point and great question. So starting from the domain, I mean, to be honest, I bought it when I saw it was available because I was kind of surprised that counterintelligence, top level PL domain is available, and it makes me look like some, national counterintelligence authority. But yeah. So a lot of this to discuss here. I'm not sure I would agree completely because from my perspective, the cyber threat intelligence practice is actually at core a counterintelligence. I mean, because since I started working in private sector in threat intelligence, to this day, I'm not running intelligence operation because my organization wants to fulfill some strategic goals and they need to, feed it into their operational plan. I'm analyzing activity of actors who are conducting espionage and intelligence and providing information, providing data or whatever the outcomes to thwart that activity. So I think essentially the threat intelligence, as it is understood in private sector, is this counterintelligence side. Now, of course, this is another debate, like how we define this counterintelligence versus counterespionage. I think what you mentioned, like with placing spies, with interrogating spies, perhaps falls on this spectrum. But ultimately, I mean, even you can see it in Poland when recently there have been multiple reports on the state activity from various from Russia, from China, then joined in the joint with other countries. I think in Poland, military counterintelligence service is one of the key players in terms of analysis of this activity and disseminating, providing information. And yeah, I think it makes perfect sense because as the counterintelligence is about like catching spies in the let's say human intelligence realm, then it's no different in cyber domain. Like we are catching the cyber spies, let's say. So it depends kind of on how you defined it and how you
Yeah, but in the
how...
in a kinetic or real world, probably if you are just private company, you will not catch a spy to interrogate and so on.
Yeah,
But
exactly. This is great point. So I wanted to like
maybe
discuss
you will, but you won't tell anyone.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I wanted to like also mention, like 2 points. First, counterintelligence and cyber threat intelligence. I think we are still kind of having often in terms of threat intelligence, kind of narrow view of the intelligence and counterintelligence, because we are focused on this technical aspect. And trying to thwart activity by detection engineering and so on. But what I'm also interested in is this kind of more, let's say, holistic counterintelligence aspect. For example, I remember there was presentation, but I believe Mandiant, about incident response on APT-29, and they were doing stuff because they would suspect that the attackers were looking into the calendars. They had access to Outlook. They were putting fake meetings to kind of make them think that they are working when they are not, and stuff like this. So I think in terms of like true counterintelligence, the cyber community is often focusing just on this very much thwarting aspect. But about this deception, and I'm not talking about honeypots or anything like that, but for example, having site communication channels where you would not be associated in any way with organization. So I remember, I think it was Grak who was suggesting, when there were leaks from the Democratic Committee in the US, to use Messenger. Yeah?
Let me put you on pause
Sure.
because it's an absolute record, I guess. So we started at 1809 and now we are like 22 minutes in, 22 minutes until Grok mentioned in our
So
podcast.
that's record, like from the it's too soon or too
It's relatively soon, I would say.
relatively
So
soon. Okay.
since we started paying attention, since we formulated this Jenkins Stiran law about the policy discussion on cyber, the longer it continues, the closer to one is the probability of mentioning Grok's name.
Okay. Yeah, so nice. Yeah, so
It was quite fast. Okay,
yeah,
so
so
Grok.
yeah, Grak, yeah, have a good one. Like say hi to Grak. Yeah, but I believe he mentioned that for this Democratic National Committee, one solution to the leaks would be that they would have like mobile phones with Facebook Messenger app with fake identities. So even if this would get leaked, it would not be attributed to like chief of staff or anything. And yeah, and having this counterintelligence aspect from just making the intelligence unusable, I think is quite underdeveloped field. Now,
Of course.
so I won't lose track of all the threats. To the Vlad's point about the catching spies and so on. Yeah, so I think this is like a perfect example of how different these fields are and how certain things became normal, because it was back 20 either 2017, 2019. I was at Secure Conference, like organized by Polish CERT, PL, and they had this presentation by FBI legal attaché from the US Embassy in Poland. And yeah, he was talking about the cooperation with the private sector, the FBI initiatives and so on. And it was time of the APT-10 indictments by the United States Department of Justice. And my first question was, is that how is it that you're using APT-10, which is a name given by a private company? And yeah, and so the group was tracked by a private company, and now it's in this indictment realm. And like, what's your view that they are free to kind of, let's burn this intelligence if they wish, basically? And it's quite unimaginable if you would have a company, and they would be running around Washington D.C. detecting, I don't know, Russia, China assets, and just putting a blog post like, yeah, those guys are, intelligence operators, and yeah, if we found them, this is the tradecraft, like APT human report. Yeah, and his response was basically like kind of general, that the private company they can do whatever they want in terms of those kind of research publication. But I mean, it's hard not to see how different things are, like exactly as you mentioned, that on my blog, I mentioned that this is kind of unique opportunity that you can work for completely private company, and it was especially prominent, I guess, in the case of Mandiant, APT1, and all the things that stem from there, and actively work against the state actors, like in terms of kinetic warfare. Again, this is, yeah, this is not something that you would expect to happen, or there might be now some, let's say, more involvement of private companies in production of military hardware, some PMCs, but
I think
definitely not on the scale that we are seeing in cyber and in this way that we are seeing.
cyber is not a military discipline, and it's not like government prerogative, right? So for as long as private entities are facing this problem of cybersecurity, I believe we will have this intelligence, counterintelligence game played by private companies, simply because otherwise it will all be classified, and the private entities will not be able to benefit from those artifacts and results. So that's what I argue when I put forward this like concept of more proactive, more proactive basically role of defense. Right, because you cannot be proactive if you do not do intelligence, if you do not understand the strategy of the threat agent, you will not be able to proactively defend. You will be downstream everything the threat agent does, because it's an agent, it has agency, it acts, and you only react. In order to shift the paradigm, you need to produce intelligence or acquire intelligence in some form, because otherwise you will be again like caged to this reactive approach, right? And we need to like broaden the concept of intelligence and counterintelligence in cyberspace, because like in human or like statecraft, counterintelligence is basically denying enemies, like adversaries, right? Adversaries' operational security, right? So there are intelligence operations. We need to stop them. For that, we undermine OPSEC. Okay, what is OPSEC? It's like concealment, cover, and compromise. We try to like reveal agents. We try to deprive them from cover, and we try to like correlate their actions in order to find who is cooperating with whom during like intelligence or subversion or sabotage operations, right? So that's what classic counterintelligence does, right? But in cyber, unfortunately, we'll have to do much, much more. We need to understand how those organizations operate, what is basically their MO, what do they do? Like, what do they do daily in order to be more productive and efficient even in actively anticipating their actions? First, their targeting. Are they biased? Are they like institutionally probable to, like to target us? Are we in the area of their interest, right? Is their toolkit fit for our defenses in order to efficiently and quickly gain initial access? Is their like analysis function prepared to like process the pile of like enormous amounts of exfiltrated data? Do they know how our business operates, and will they be able to produce like actionable intelligence upon what they exfiltrate? So that's all in our interest, to be intelligent about what kind of threat is there, and what degree of threat they pose to us. So in no case we have to be constrained with the traditional definitions borrowed from classic statecraft, right? That's what I'm trying to underline here.
Yes, so only thing I would add or I would emphasize is that Things are very different from the start because private sector was kind of thrown in the situation. So when we saw all those state
Exactly.
activities that were targeting like industrial espionage, economic espionage, this ransomware disruption, whatever that is, I mean, the attack surface of private sector of all the companies in critical infrastructure and not only is like magnitudes different than what would be theoretical target for kinetic attacks. And this brought like both, let's say, the burden of having to start producing intelligence, but also the wealth of data. Like, I mean, if the actors are trying to get in, this is how we can derive intelligence. So in one way, I don't think there was any other possibility, like because simply this is what happened. The state actors started attacking the private sector, and the scale is just enormous. I think it was the FBI director who said that they are opening some China-related counterintelligence case every 10 hours, and probably many of those were cyber-related. So there are, simply not the
There are a lot of Chinese.
not that many, people in the United States to handle in law enforcement or anyway to
I
handle
was
all
quite
those
surprised
cases.
when I learned that the full staff of FBI is smaller in numbers than New York Metro Police.
Yeah, I mean, New York is huge, like. Yeah, but yes, so obviously the government will not have the resources that they should come and help with their, let's say, whole of government approach, because state, of course, have this dime field framework, like diplomatic economic means to exert pressure and to steer some behaviors. But in terms of like sheer numbers of the investigations to be done and sheer number of intelligence products, like there is no way that private sector can be left out of this. So definitely notions change. I think also what changed is the professionalization of the intelligence function in private sector. That was consequence of that. Like we saw, stemming from the companies that were involved in response to state activity, like Google during Operation Aurora, like CrowdStrike and their own tracking of Russian activity, also Chinese activity. So, all, and because of the money that was behind this, the ratio of the professional working in private sector versus government sector in terms of intelligence skills and cyber incident analysis, let's say, changed. So I think we are at this point, like there is for some time now no going back in terms of how those sector have to cooperate, because without the government support, there will be no visibility, let's say, into things that can
Of
come
course.
from either SIGINT, and from the private sector there won't be this wealth of data that's coming from the frontline analysis. So here we are, that if
And
you want to work on
yeah.
state activities, you can pick and choose which flavor you want, basically.
And you will have to believe me when I say it that when the crisis comes, the state is most interested in as many private individuals being well versed in these matters as possible.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, the Polish Cyber Command.
Yeah,
How
prior to pushing
so
record,
we
having
were
like
talking
discussion
about
about who knows what, like,
the
yeah, we
Polish
mentioned
Cyber
Cyber
Command, and
Command.
they are heavily out in the community and recruiting. Just recently they started, I think, quite nice initiative. It's called Cyber Legion. So they are encouraging folks to step up and to not necessarily outright join the reserve forces, but be involved in some projects. I think I know there was a conference to kind of inaugurate that just recently. So yeah, I mean, especially in like, if there is technically like unlimited work hours to be done and very limited number of people who can do it, like it's you can't afford to lose the resources that you might have.
How often does this intelligence go in these depths that Vlad mentioned? Because if talking about private sector, it's usually attribution, usually published blog, right? Some IOCs, maybe some feedback loop to detection engineering. But is there any understanding also from private sector, right, from your experience, that you need to kind of know who are those attackers, like really like persons, how their like daily schedule looks like and so on.
So that's a good one, because there are multiple approaches. Like, I think it's what the main difference is, or the two main ones is what I'm call the threat actor based approach and the activity group. So some folks who prefer to have like the threat actor and to understand like who is behind this, like have this hard attribution, let's say, done. Some folks are more into activity group. So tracking only the technical observables and like victimology, but not necessarily linking it back to the activity. I mean, for private sector, I think it becomes increasingly important to understand the attribution, even if it can't be achieved by just, the internal means. So you might not be able to attribute the activity, but because there are resources there, like from the government side or from companies like Microsoft that have higher visibility and can link this activity, then you can perhaps mix and match what you're seeing in your environment to what's the likely, let's say, attribution. And I think if you can get that knowledge, it's great. It's important, because ultimately this will translate to intent and kind of assessment of if you are actually targeted. Because as we are seeing now from multiple groups, the move towards, let's say, supply chain compromise, something like we have seen with APT-10 8-ish, 7-ish years ago, I think it's now coming back with these attempts to compromise the service providers and then pivot out. So yes, so even having knowledge, if this group is interested in your data or is interested in data of your customers, gives you much context in terms of the investigation, in terms of incident response, and so on. I think there was for a long time being like this notion that attribution is not that important for private sector, because A, it doesn't change the technical defenses, and B, you're not government, so you so you can't do anything about it. But yeah, I think it was quite, let's say, immature understanding of how things will go. Like I know there were prominent and very smart people who kind of were on this side on defense, but yeah, given the complexity of the threat, I think it's you can like you can't miss this piece of a puzzle. Like, especially if you can, and now with the resources and cooperation between companies, and yeah, having these government initiatives, you can in many ways, and this can give you a lot to work on in terms of how you will stage defenses, how you will think about the threats that come, prioritization, if anything, of what's going after your networks. So I think also things change. I would say for the better for the because I mean, you could say that
Let's
things
hope
are
so.
yeah things are more. I think you could, like, from the external perspective, you could say things are worse. But I would say it's because we
No,
have
I
more visibility now,
I'm not
and that's
saying
how
things
it.
are worse. I'm not saying things are worse. I think that we are well positioned to at least like start very intensively like breaking these technical mentality constraints. I like to sum it up with just one phrase. S in TTP stands for strategy.
I think we had this conversation at Cycony, but
Exactly. Yeah. So
I
that's basically the main message, right? So when you are dealing with the basic commodity level threats, you're okay by just like establishing a baseline, right? To take security essentials, implement them, control them, measure them, you're gonna be okay. Once you are facing an APT level threat, sorry, you will have to understand what you're dealing with, because
Yeah,
that's
I
your main
think,
concern now. Sorry, that
I
life is
think
hard.
it goes further. Like, what's a commodity threat now? Like, ransomware group? That's the
No,
possibly.
not all the ransomware groups are very well organized international
Yes,
bureaucracies.
sure.
There are
But when
still
you're,
amateurs, you know.
yeah, sure. But when you're looking at like the outcomes, the derivatives, and when you see the ransomware ecosystem with some being like a state permitted groups, let's say. and having their role in
Yeah, the
in
line is
leverage.
blurred.
Yeah, lands
I
are rolling.
agree,
So,
yeah.
so even if you're dealing with e-crime, you can just have the let's say comfort of staying on the technical lane. And yeah, I'm just putting the countermeasures against TTPs, and we are good because you will not
Those
see. Oh.
time are gone.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess like one thought like that. At the same time, you shouldn't forget about more mass attacks, right? And the initial access brokers and so on, because all these technical reports, I guess, on intelligence on APT groups, they will be focused on, okay, they're using this malware, right? They're using these specific TTPs, which happen like later on, right? If you have still some holes in just like very easy defense, you won't be protected. So also kind of only focusing on ATPs, I
Well, I
guess,
think
not
it's
enough, right?
Alex, sorry, but I think that there is a lot
Yeah.
of selection bias here. If you have a hammer,
Maybe.
everything you see, it's just we focus on that. That's why we see a lot of it. That's the
Right,
main problem,
exactly.
I think. It's better to think about, okay, I'm a threat to Russians. Okay, so how do Russians operate? Because that's a better angle to approach the problem in the first place. Because like if I'm a threat to Russians, I need to like classify the threat. First of all, is it intelligence or is it sabotage, right? If I'm not in the state of war with Russia, so I have to build my defenses differently to if I am, right? Because this security dilemma doesn't go away. If you're at like non-war, at peace state, probably you are a target to intelligence operations. So probably you need to focus more and go deeper in order to reveal the threat, right? It will not reveal itself. It will try to stay concealed for as long as possible. That's how you need to approach things in the very first place. But otherwise, you will never detect it because you will just think
That's
everything is
correct.
okay,
I
right?
think Alex is not objecting to this,
Yeah,
My point is that
Yeah.
it should be cumulative, right? Like that you shouldn't be only focused on this Russian APT, right? And only on reports about this whatever malware they use.
You should also have a strong password and
Yeah.
MFA.
No. That's what I've started
To
with. Like
prevent essentials
some
are
initial kick leaks or
important.
initial exits. Because
Sorry,
that's
Camille. That
w yeah.
that's what we escalate into from time to time discussing topics
No
among
issue.
ourselves.
No
Sorry.
issue. Yeah, just had one comment because sometimes I feel like we are living in this dual reality. Like when Alex just mentioned the commodity threats and we mentioned password and so on. So on one hand, I think with the current EDR solutions, like from many great providers, like I'm not affiliated with any, but I think like CrowdStrike or SentinelOne on Microsoft, they are doing great job and they are providing visibility that it was not possible some years before, and they've got the hunting modules. They've got great detection models. So you would think that this very low level of the threats of the cyber intrusions, like we could get off the table essentially, but it's simply not what's happening. And I'm quite involved also in tracking the adversarial infrastructure and the networks used. And when we look on the side of the devices, I'm not even saying IoT, but edge devices, routers, mail gateways, and so on. I mean, it's not great, let's say. So on one thing, we have this very advanced technical solution, like they've got, you've got a kernel driver, and you can see all the
But once
processes, and
again,
you're great. But then there are no.
you research that, you have a paper on that. Why did they move towards the edge? Because it's
Well, path of
harder to
least
persist on
resistance.
endpoints. Because what? XDRs, right? That's a
Of course, of
natural state
course.
of the art, right? It moves where it's easier. You cannot install CrowdStrike on your like smartwatch or smart bubble or whatever smart stuff you have
Yeah,
in your office,
but
right?
it's smart. It's one thing. You can't install it on a smartphone. But we are talking about like routers from this
Yeah, of
well-established
course,
companies.
sure.
So it's like the essential infrastructure still got some
And it's not
many
that
many
hard,
issues.
as
Yeah,
people think.
it's not that hard. So we are at this conundrum when you've got like have your cyber hygiene and have the passwords and be careful with info stealer and so on. That should be detected by any EDR basically. But then we've got also personal devices and perhaps the threats related to this. So we are at this. At the same time, like very, very high level of technical defense and very low level. And we are this threat intelligence for me is kind of navigating. Okay, as you were saying, you were targeted by Russians, so they might do this or they might do that. And it does not mean that it will be all like super high technical level. It will be what
Yeah, and you can
they
add
have this.
also like OT, right? Or
It will
this
be what
industrial
works.
systems, which are kind of
Just completely another game.
another dimension, like separate universe. And usually in cyber sense, quite low prote oh, quite yeah,
Because you
more
basically
poorly
are not allowed to
protected.
touch anything. You will void your warranty and support contract and whatever. Isolate and pray.
Yeah, I mean, I isolate is like try to isolate and
Air
pray
gap
to.
and just pray the availability gods. That's a strategy, unfortunately, but it is. Okay, good. Good talk. So what you're up to tomorrow? What's your talk about?
It's day
Give us
after
a sneak
tomorrow.
peek. Oh, it's day
Yeah.
after tomorrow, but this episode will be released like in a
Ah,
week, I guess. So you can say whatever
okay,
you want.
perfect, perfect.
No
Yeah,
spoilers here.
no spoilers. So day after tomorrow, I'm at Oh My Hack. I will be at Oh My Hack, the conference in Warsaw, one of the I think bigger one in Polish cybersecurity community, and I will be talking about the involvement of contractors in state operations. So quite a lot of analysis of the because we had nice leaks from those various companies that were involved in the operation. And when we were talking about the attribution, about the understanding of the adversarial aspects, like I can't stop thinking about the example that I'm also providing there, like from the iSun leaks. So this company in China that was providing services to the to various government agencies, and also it involved outsourcing of intrusions, essentially that they were conducting intrusions, getting paid for it. There was this quite well-publicized case that they managed to breach accounts, breach data of Jens Stoltenberg when he was still Secretary General of NATO. So high-level target by all means. But then when you go to the leaked conversation, the leaked communication they had in the there was in the leaks. It turns out that they breached him all right, but they couldn't sell the data because the customer was not interested and couldn't verify how they would use this. And basically they were left out there. So when I'm thinking also about the attribution, about understanding like those the very different perspectives that you might have depending on the picture you are getting. So if you would get like in the abstract this information, the breach against NATO Secretary General, you would think about the AP top APT team that's been the task
No.
specifically for high level target. No, not at all. Like they
Bad
were
targeting. Bad targeting,
they essentially
dudes.
they missed their target. Like it was not
Yes.
required by customer. They are now sitting on this pile
But
of data they can sell, and it's completely different. Yeah.
isn't it the basis of China's like overall policy? Like giving out like priorities, like announcing priorities and then awarding results. Right, dude.
Yeah,
I don't think
so.
there was like intelligence requirement like translated to the company, right? So they went out, they exfiltrated some data, they compiled an intelligence product, and they just couldn't sell it because it was not good intelligence. But isn't it the way it generally works in China?
So with ISUN, yes, so this is a super interesting discussion to be had, because with ISUN, essentially, they were kind of very much a low-tier contractor company. So when you go through the leagues, there
So
were
apparently
multiple.
they have not the best OPSEC in the world.
As you can tell, there were many issues internally. The employees were looking for another jobs while they were at ISUN. They once breached a company that was not on the target list, and then there was apparently cover up to not let it out and not let the handlers know about it. They were paid like some for intrusion into, I guess, Vietnam Ministry of Economy. They were paid like $50,000, so not a lot of money for that kind of target. So there were a lot of issue with this, and this represents like the spectrum of the companies, because you had ISON, then let's say you had the Chengdu 404 that was related, I believe, to to APT 41, and they had like US DOJ indictment, and it was like proper APT activity. Then you have the ecosystem of companies around Hafnium / Silk Typhoon, I guess, and also the contractors who were working on this. So there is a lot to be discussed here. And as you sometimes consider China, like, this is a communist state, everything is controlled by the party. Like, this is not true at all. This is
No.
myth.
Cyber market is super
Yeah,
liberated.
exactly. And there is this co concept in when the China started developing cybersecurity policy, like trying to steer the sector. There is this concept called Zhengzhe Xinxin. So this is policy first, or the policy drives the steering, let's say. Policy as in the directives that can be issues, like how the national priorities are set. And basically from those cybersecurity directives, or putting the cybersecurity as a part of the national strategy, there were a bunch of initiatives. I think the most prominent, also I will be talking about this at the conference, is the Cyber Rangers. So there is a whole sector in China specialized in providing the attack defense simulation environment. And this, for example, drives the national CTF competition. Like the one of the biggest companies, Integrity Tech, is handling like around half of the major CTF competitions. And this serves both as the testing ground for the defenses. And for example, one the cybersecurity law mandated that critical infrastructure providers have to do those kind of drills. So it driven the market growth. But on the other hand, it directly provides like the offensive capabilities, because they are
Of
tested
course.
out there and so on. So this is like the dual pipeline. The government is providing funding, regulatory support, then private sector is bringing their guys, let's say, and they are doing those kind of developments in terms of offensive security, defensive security. It all converges, let's say, in terms of various APT groups. So we have a lot interconnections in private sector, even if you would not think about it this way in China.
It should be a great talk because you focus on the region and you
And
will
no.
present.
I mean, yeah, there is a.
Actually, I caught myself with the thought that about region, that you introduce yourself now as responsible for Middle East, but we talk today about everything like Russia, China, US,
I
but
mean,
not the Middle
that's
East.
that's like my job. That's my job, what I'm responsible at my current position. But in terms of activity, like for this talk, for example, there will be also the analysis of NTC Vulcan and how they were in Russia placed, and when providing those tooling, especially, I think, interesting in terms of how they were providing tooling that combined, or was supposed to test, combining OT attacks and information operation. And this is something that, again, private sector observed. I remember Cyber Warcon talk by Mandiant, who were discussing this GRU playbook on telegraphing success operations. So it all kind of comes together. And yeah, and Iran in the Middle East is another different ball game because their approach to contractors and or to the cyber capabilities was mixed again of the government side and, for example, the forums and the cyber ecosystem of grassroots initiatives that were then tasked and incentivized to go against targets. So yeah, I mean, a lot going on in different parts of the world, and yeah, and
I
the
have a question.
community. Yeah, go on.
Where is the borderline? Where is the threshold of actual state activity in China? Because I'm almost convinced that Salt Typhoon, as an intelligence operation, most probably was outsourced, but Volt Typhoon probably was PLA as like a preparation of operational
Intelligence preparation,
environment,
yeah,
you
of a
know?
battlefield, yeah.
Like, is there like a policy defined like threshold?
So
You do
I
not do this, you do only below the threshold stuff.
yes, so I don't think so at the stage of like general directives. I think it's inherent to how the contractors are tasked. So, for example, when we are talking about the Volt Typhoon, yeah, I'm not sure, like off top of my head, if there were links to any contractors or related companies. But definitely, like the Flax Typhoon was related to contractors, and I think Aquatic Panda as well. I can't recall now. But it's in terms of espionage operations, it's like whole spectrum. I'm not sure about, as you are mentioning, intelligence preparation of battlefield, if this is something that PLA want to be exclusive in, and if so, if it's because of OPSEC consideration, because they want ISUN to be involved in such operation,
Yeah, I
or
bet.
because you know lack of trust or lack of capabilities. But I think the borders come more from the tasking and from the, let's say, project management on the contractor side. I'm not sure. I'm not privy definitely to, like, you know, the doctrine
It's not
or the policies.
at this point it's not possible to reverse engineer it
Yeah,
from the public policy.
yeah,
Okay. So what do you think about this doxing of an Iranian group that aside from like normal cyber APT and OSINT and information operation stuff ran a kamikaze drone unit?
yeah. So yeah, I'm just in, actually, yeah, I'm in the middle of those leaks right now, and I think it's nothing new to see moonlighting of operation. It goes back again to some groups like for on the, of course, a different scale, but I think again Mandiant with APT41 or FireEye then mentioned how they were the mixing the financial motivation and espionage. I mean, it depends, especially with Iran. I would say it's a bit eclectic in terms of how they are, because the capabilities are, or the resources are, in general smaller. It's also more, they need to be more agile in terms of who is doing what. So I mean, I have to dig more into those leaks to make some informed assessment. Yeah, but I would say like it's more expertise driven. I would say, like, if they were capable of running the drone operation,
No, it's
then yeah,
you know,
they.
it's my take on that is very simple. The Western analysts are like making jokes of them because it's like very unnatural in the West to like everyone do everything. But in the end of the day, if the guys are so good at cyber that they could actually produce like targeting for drones, but maybe they're not that capable to sell those targeting packages then to like legit drone operators. So maybe just in the end, like the government, like whatever management they have, just decided to give them that mandate and capabilities.
Yeah,
Just you go and try it
exactly.
out.
Like,
Maybe you will be efficient. Why not? You
yeah,
know?
exactly. Like, if you don't have also, yeah, also about the presentation, I will be talking not only about the Eastern side, but how it kind of is evolving in West. So I'm starting basically from how at NSA, I dig down how they had different badges for contractors. So like, you know, different colored badges. the designated if you are employee at the NSA or if you're a contractor. So it's not new to get involved folks, but I think there was this very much, let's say, reservations against mixing the private sector into offensive capabilities. And I think this because of, let's say, rule of law consideration, because of having this, government monopoly of violence policy and so
Monopoly.
on.
Monopoly on cyber force.
Cyber
State
weapons.
monopoly on cyber violence.
Something like this. I think it might be changing now. There are some
Oh,
companies
yeah,
that more
very much.
overtly, but even some companies are more overtly advertising that they
Of
provide
course, yeah.
this kind of capabilities. And this is the change we are seeing. So yes, so interesting because actually when you dig down in the China sources and the analysis of the cyber ranges, they, for example, one of the major, let's say, architect of this approach estimated that China is lagging like 12 years or something like this behind in terms of cyber ranges, in terms of how they are mature. But then, I mean, it's not, but then when you look at the when you look
That's
at
not what I would
the
agree with.
maybe he wanted funding, but what was but no, I think it can be true to on organizational level and the technical sophistication, but then when you
But
have this
operational
overt.
sophistication eats technical sophistication.
But in terms of like not only offense but those cyber ranges and the preparations of cyber offense operations, but now perhaps West will become more overt and it was the assessment based on the visibility and what's like how the market looks like, for example, in terms of the
Yeah,
solutions.
that's all interesting and very very like up to date, like very actual topics. But what's up with Poland? What's going on? I don't know, maybe Andrei will be a better person to interrogate you on that, but like from my side, everything looks quite dim, quite I'm not like a pessimist in the question when it comes to Europe's like overall readiness to fight, including cyber, but I'm a skeptic, I would say, right? So what do you think about like overall European policy? Does it shift towards more like proactive and aggressive stance, or is it still deep into, again, like exercises, readiness, private
I
public
think
cooperation, all this kind of stuff, building
I th
resilience instead of like actively gaining operational experience, but you know
Yeah,
what I
so of
mean, right?
course we won't have like visibility into what's actually going on. From the external visibility, the priority is on readiness and perspective, I think for multiple reasons related to how also West want to be perceived and very much avoid or be seen as a defense force, as NATO being defense alliance, not adding to the any provocations that might occur and so on. In terms of, I mean, and the efforts for cyber readiness in Poland definitely are showing as we discuss this Cyber Legion initiative or how the Polish cyberspace defense forces are trying to gain resources, are active, how the what the sharing of data in coordination with agencies from other countries. On the offensive side, I mean, I don't think we have visibility. I don't think we have major examples. I would expect that at this stage, the offensive operations are probably mainly, if any, the preparation of battlefields. Like I would expect that quite a few intelligence agency would be and military also would be tasked to like if stuff goes down to be able to contribute to the disruption effort, let's say, of the forces, but it's hard to make educated guesses on the extent or level those. I think the what also the Russian invasion of Ukraine showed that still the kinetic warfare is let's say magnitudes orders of magnitudes just more, let's say, impactful than cyber operation. And still, given the level of disruption, disruption from the attacks against critical infrastructure, even the coordination of attacks between cyber and the kinetic, I think the West Europe is concerned with building up the traditional defenses. I mean, in Poland, it's very visible with the spending on the equipment and yeah, just expanding the army and the armed forces that we have. Of course, this suffers from the usual issues with having the stakes in it. So as we are seeing, let's say, less involvement from Portugal or the issues with the countries to the west of the of Russia. But yeah, so I think it's answering your question. I think it's mainly readiness at this stage. I don't think West wants to, especially as the also now negotiations are going and so on, be seen as this, you know, putting another being incident to be negotiated about, let's say, so you know, so that we are very defensive, peaceful, and yeah, and we are trying to
That
contribute
is
to
very
everything.
sad.
Yeah,
But
the rest.
at least in Poland, they don't underestimate the threat from
Yeah, I
West.
mean it's hard for
Yeah, of
Poland to
course.
underestimate.
Yeah,
But
after the week before last, it's I don't think
yeah.
it's possible. I was traveling the other route, you know, and I was like 4 hours late when I started thinking that probably I should have like first traveled from what's the place? Rzeszów, right? From Rzeszów to Warsaw and then to Prague. But then I heard the news about the sabotage of that exact line, the train line
Perfect.
that would take me to Warsaw. And I thought, yeah, 4 hours delay is not that big of
Yeah,
a
not that
problem.
big deal. Yeah, I mean, but even before, like we had those arsons that were attributed to
Did you
saboteur.
read this Politico piece on different policymakers, at least in like Brussels on the European level, being ready to take like more proactive stance, let's say, like but they are talking about like reacting to Russian sabotage in terms of like snap exercises in Poland and the Baltics, right? And even probably offensive cyber attacks, which I see as a like major shift in thinking about stuff, because for me cyber is like inherently non-escalatory domain, and you basically can do whatever you want in cyber and just then like enjoy misattributions all around, you know. It's why
Yeah,
not?
but
You
yeah, I mean,
at least you will get some operational experience,
yeah,
you
maybe
know.
that's why they mentioned cyber specifically because they understand that
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
there is the lightest offense possible in sense. Well, if they would
It's
change the
way,
pol
way below the offense definition in international law, right? It's like,
yeah,
yeah.
because you mean non-escalatory from like practical aspect or let's say norms
From
as.
empirical observations,
Yeah,
okay?
yes. So I think the threat here is that yes, but the West got because of the digitalization, because of how our society is working, got much to lose from retaliatory. I mean, I don't think that the Russia would care much for the attribution to be very
Oh,
precise.
of course, of course.
But and with what we've seen with just ransomware groups and like the United States Colonial Pipeline, JBL, and so on. There is hesitancy about this kind of direct destructive
But again,
responses
look,
that can be.
they are non-discrete in what they target, right? So if you're thinking about being targeted in a retaliatory action, then maybe it makes sense. But overall, the chip will get you, you know, one way or another, you will be a target. Either of like state, not encouraged but tolerated ransomware groups, or directly by state-sponsored or state-coordinated contractors, right? I don't know, maybe I'm just a fatalist, and maybe I live in such a what do you call it, target-rich environment, you know, that I'm quite I'm quite tolerant to the idea that one way or another, you will be a subject to cyber conflict. So why not enjoying the advantage of initiative? You know, just from a purely theoretical perspective.
So, from my point of view, there is ma this hesitancy might also stem from very down-to-earth political factors of who is gaining popularity in
Oh,
European
that's a much
polls.
more practical explanation. Thank you.
And then the government does not want to see seen like, to provoke, let's say, provoke
Yeah.
Russia and
For as
then
long
have.
as the Party of Peace like
Yeah.
is more like popular, let's say, right? The populist agenda will not include any offensive action. But when we get a situation as like, I don't know, in the US, for example, right? That shifts the agenda momentarily, right? So offensive cyber operations are like preferable. There is like reshuffle of advisories in the White House and like prominent figures in the area in this like field of the industry thinking like that are gaining
But
positions of trust and decision making.
That's I think also interesting. Yes, but is it so? I remember the first Trump administration when John Bolton was still national security advisor and was on better terms with Trump, and he was, I believe, quite loudly advertising the idea of stepping up the cyber operations to impose cost, let's say, but not sure it
But it's even
matter.
more so nowadays.
Yeah, but is it materializing? Like this is United States conducting
You
this
know,
kind of?
will we ever know?
Yeah, will we ever know?
Yeah.
But
Right.
there definitely there is no,
No,
for example.
given the appointments, I would derive
Which
a
appointments?
conclusion. JD Work, Emily Goldman, right? You know,
I was also thinking
I would
about.
assume that something is going on.
Yeah, something is going on. Yeah, but when you look, for example, I mean, it's hard to gauge the intent of the current US administration. But given the, let's say, given, for example, Elbridge Colby is in the Department of Defense, and given your assertion that cyber is not escalatory, would we see something, for example, in terms of Asia Pacific theater? Like I would expect by this point, basically. Not sure, what are the equities consideration,
Anything,
but yeah,
anything
but
would
it would
be
be
anything would be tolerable enough after Voltaire, you know.
Yes, I think I would
But
like experience.
leaving that unanswered would be a sign of weakness. I think like a lot of folks are working on a retaliatory action right now as we
Yeah,
speak.
but Volt Typhoon, let's say, ultimately, I don't know how to call it, did not materialize. I mean, there was a staging, but there was no disruption. So if the same is happening, certainly.
Let me maybe rephrase it like this. So the part of Volt Typhoon that was discovered did not materialize. Okay. Well, that's it. Like if China embraces persistence in cyberspace, so probably this kind of activity is going on like perpetually
Oh,
and
so for sure.
continually, right? So the only parts that we see released to public are first discovered by something adjacent to public sector to private sector first of all, because public sector would probably just put it undercover and just classify it and would never reveal it. No reason to declassify and leak it. Just why, right? Is it in
Yeah, I feel
public
like
interest? No. Is it in the national security interest? No. So why?
exactly
Sorry,
like
Alex.
I guess like I have like a similar point, right? That when we are claiming that cyberspace, and all these operations are not escalatory, we also looking at asymmetric data, right, from the past when kind of Russia attacked mostly right west, west didn't do anything, so we claim that it's not escalatory. But probably like number of attacks towards Russia was much less, right, and so on. At least like those are not known, right?
So kind of my understanding is that when something happens in Europe, for example, right, everyone in Russia knows, okay, we did it, right? And that's their
No, no,
mentality.
no, no. First of all, probably do not underestimate the ability of Russians to keep things
Maybe.
undercover.
Yeah, it's kind of un I would say it's
Enormous amount
undercover.
of that ability.
Undercover in terms of specific attribution and
Oh, no,
whatever
no, no,
kind of
no. Even
international
like
case, right?
the fact of it happening, you know, major telecom providers went down in Russia, and there is no publicly available data about that.
Exactly.
Okay,
That's
the
another scenario.
only places that give you hints about that is this SOC forum or PH Days or whatever conference they are still holding, right? And they come to the stage and they describe this like incident response activity, this huge enterprise of people and technical tools involved, and no names. You know, no titles, no last names, no brand names, no whatever, no nothing. You know, and from there you can like very you can make an educated guess at most, right? But nothing leaks to the public domain. Nothing. So maybe something is going on. We just don't know about it.
And I guess like on the West side, right, if they do such operation, for example, I guess Ukraine will definitely acknowledge we did it, right, and so on. But from Europe point of view, I guess they kind of how they can use it, right? Politics, how they can use it. Okay, we attacked Russia, right? They probably will be scared about
No,
that in
as
terms of
Camille said,
legal.
it can be political and popular, you know, to announce that because like no one will support you. It's just an offensive faction. Why do you do it? You're a country adhering to rule of law. You're like this great democracy. Why would you do that? Why would you attack another country? You know, this kind of
But I
thinking.
guess that gives us only possibility that you can kind of counterattack. Okay, let's say we disrupted infrastructure of this threat actor, right, or something like that. That can be publicly claimed and in positive way.
Yes, so I think that was
You will
what
win
was
my vote,
happening.
but it's very hard to
No,
sell it to the general public.
I think that one was actually quite of sold successfully because it was Internet Research Agency that was disrupted, and then Task Force RS for the I mean terrorists are, let's say, easy target for political points. But when there, I think it's when there is a link like for Russia and the disruption of the democratic process. And then there is like direct response. This is, I think, when there was much weakness from the US policy, when the Obama did some kind of, or there was some communications, some telegraphing of red lines in terms of the disruption of electoral process, which I think should be like anything to do with touching elections in United States. And this is not exactly, as far as I remember, 2016-ish. This is not exactly how it went down. But I think in case of this situation between, let's say, Europe and Russia, like we are trying this peace process, let's say, we are trying to de-escalate, we are working towards ending the invasion and stuff like that, then the offensive actions are kind of seen as escalatory by itself, because you are stoking the flames. Depends. Even though for Poland it might not be escalatory compared to what's going on, but what we have seen in United States when there was like cyber interference and the cyber interference on their side followed, I think it's much simpler to do. So I was wondering, because in Poland, not only in Poland, but in Poland there were these constant attacks, DDoS attacks by no name and so on. And this included, for example, in my hometown, one of the biggest oncology center in Poland. So I don't think there would be much issue justifying disruption, for example, of no name, because
Of
you
course,
just
yeah.
would have to print out from Telegram they are attacking hospitals. Like, okay,
I
so
very
we are
much
attacking with deaths.
like the stance that Australians took. You know, they identified, they declared all the organized cybercrime groups like ransomware and the like legitimate targets for cyber operations. It's a great way to gain operational experience. That's the first and the most useful way of applying such kind of policy, I guess. And they are doing a thing that is in general public's best interest. not even like constrained to Australian national security interests. It's a good thing to disrupt cybercrime operations worldwide.
Yeah, so, but then it goes back to like deeper, let's say, higher level consideration regarding the nature of state activities, because you are again mixing the military with law enforcement, and I think this is inherently
Oh,
seen.
that's not military that's doing it in Australia. I think it's ASD's mandate, so it's like intelligence, counterintelligence stuff.
Yeah, but still, like foreign intelligence agency getting involved in law
They're all
enforcement fish.
civilians. They're all
No, but
civilians.
yes, the civilians for sure, but it's like,
No, I get
CIA is
what you're
civilian, but
thinking. Yeah,
if you touch
of course.
CIA with going after criminals, then things change. So this is probably good from the technical and effectiveness standpoint. It might be difficult from the legal perspective from the countries, and
That's
also
what that's why I'm asking your lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my law degree is quite far away, but yeah, trying to double it. Yeah, but for Poland, for example, it was also very interesting conversation and debate, because I was interested, like, when the Cyberspace Defense Command was, yes, yeah, Cyberspace Defense Forces basically set up how they will manage the jurisdiction, and what does it mean that cyber operations are conducted, and like, what's the mandate, and so on. But in the law on the, I think it's quite wide law on the defense of Republic of Poland, or defense of homeland, basically, that codified different aspects. It was stated that cyber operations are considered to be conducted on the territory of Poland. So I mean, that's from my perspective, it gives a very wide mandate, because there is separate law on the use of Polish armed forces beyond borders of Poland, and this requires, I believe, parliamentary consent. I think also so some president getting involved, but definitely there is like a separate thing, like when Poland was sending
And
troops to Iraq,
probably
it's
only in response to armed aggression or to support like some international agreement, like helping allies or something, right?
yeah. I mean, it's very, very, let's say, very. It's a separate thing. Like, it's got its own procedures, and it's quite well defined. And for this cyberspace operation, like when I saw this, that cyber operations are considered to be conducted on the territory of Poland, I think it gives quite a wide leeway to what you can
Of
do
course.
from the
What's that?
perspective of cyber
My Proton server, my Proton exit
command.
has Polish IP, or do I reside in Poland, or
Yeah,
what? Can I
no,
speak Polish?
exactly. So,
Everyone is
it's my, so
there.
yeah,
Am I
so
a
I think,
co-founder of a Polish limited liability company?
yes, so it might change the calculus, but this is still military. So there will be consideration about the legitimate military targets, rules of engagement, if any, and stuff like this. But for the going after, yeah, I think going after cybercrime operation, this is way more complicated and interesting discussion. Definitely, United States got much experience with using military in various angles against like the terrorist group, against maybe now cartels in Mexico, and
Not
discussions about legality are to be heard.
joining international conventions as a state policy, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, but in terms of the
In
in terms of
contrast to Russia's joining, signing, and then not adhering to international conventions.
You can't have it all. But in Poland, like, for the intelligence agency's mandate is also, of course, set in law. And so in Poland, in terms of criminal procedure and the adjacent activities, you've got, not sure if that's correct translated, but you've got like the operational activities, which are like surveillance, let's say espionage, stuff like this, and you've got criminal procedure activities that are used, for example. So the wiretapping can be done through criminal procedure or as part of this surveillance. And this changes how what are the necessary safeguards, the judicial oversight that is necessary, because for even for those operational activities, the judicial sign-off is required. So, for example, if you would like to go for groups in different countries, what would be the judicial authority jurisdiction to sign this off? So there are consideration on the level of safeguards and the how law specifies it. Okay.
Yeah, I guess we're already doing overtime a little bit. On this note, I do have one more question, like very quick one, if possible.
Sure.
So we mentioned like CTS is just like for as a way to make cyber operations more effective, right? And
Yes.
I wonder like how all these exercises these days more realistic, because I guess like in my experience with CTF, at least in the past, that many challenges are a bit artificial, right, and so on and so forth. There were like people who like CTFs who don't like. So how does how these exercises look like, I guess, these days?
So coming back to this China national policies and this environment, I would recommend also research from Eugenio Benicassa, who is now at the Zurich ETH, and he done the two great reports. I think the first one is called From Vegas to Chengdu, that described how the culture, CTF culture that was at Black Hat, that was at DEF CON, translated into Chinese ecosystem and hacking culture. And the second one is called, I believe, Before Vegas. And that dates back to how the China ecosystem of hackers, how the grassroots movements translated into company owners and the executives, and how it went from there. So for the CTF, I mean, again, in China, it's now a huge industry of cyber ranges, so simulated environments, so having this attack defense capability, offense defense capabilities tested there. But also, when we are talking about this kind of environments of CTFs, like you mentioned, some of them feel artificial or not very, let's say, real life scenario. I mean, it depends on who you would like to attract with those, because if it's a pipeline for the state to generate cyber forces essentially, then the nature of the CTF, of the how what are the exact technical operation technical details, let's say, does not matter that much compared to that you are attracting folks who will be interested in there and can solve maybe like a technical question that's very artificial, of, I don't know, writing a shell code or solving some programmatic coding task that will later translate to them being able to program an offensive toolkit or prepare capabilities for the state. And yeah, and in terms of shine, I mean, when we look at the, for example, pound to own history, and the various consideration, like Chinese researchers being banned from participating internationally, the Chinese national vulnerability database, and how the vendors or the researchers had to disclose vulnerabilities. The having the structure for development of those core technical skills that are later on molded, let's say, or are can be directed in proper direction is enough. I'm not that familiar with exact specific, like, for example, how the latest CTFs look like or how this competition looks. I don't think that we would see like a tectonic shift in that they are now something completely out of ordinary, something that's not seen anywhere else. Those will be still like cyber ranges, scenarios to test the defenses, to have those kind of capture, deflect through intrusion, and so on. But in the grand scheme of things, it's an element that's used for the particular goal. So here, from directing the efforts of the interested crowd into the operation, and from the other side, to have this offense, like simulating offense capabilities for purpose of national security. I think even one company, can't recall which, is now Elex, I think it was called, that's responsible for this cyber ranges. Many of them are run by very patriotic kind, and they like tagline is forging spears and shields for national security. So it shows like the also the attitude of the development of those. So yeah, so not sure if the can won't comment like on top of my head on technical details, but I don't think it's necessary to have extremely realistic scenario to generate forces, let's say, in terms of cyber personnel.
I guess like
In a
when it comes
way,
like for
please
defense
go.
side, I guess like there like it's more important, right, to be more realistic and all this threat hunting, threat intelligence sharing that we discussed. So is it like a part of these like CTFs as exercises, cyber exercises on the West?
In the West, so yes, so I think West, because when we talk about, for example, locked shields, this is very much, and I think it's great strength of this exercise, how much this is focused on this whole of state response, because on locked shields, like you've got the part about the IT security, but you've also got like the legal aspects and the OT and the information operations. So really, I mean, I'm participating in Lock Shields, of course, can disclose any like details about its how it progresses, but it really feels like I'm in the Windows defense team, so doing very much frontline like incident response activities, but feels very much like being, a cog in this greater structure, because I've got colleagues from the media team that's good that are doing those response to the some propaganda operations or how the intrusions are being presented. And for the defense, I think it's extremely important, because like I think it's Helmut von Moltke, or there is this saying that no plan survives the first contact with enemy, and that's definitely true for the cyber operation. Like when stuff will actually go down, it will not be like in your incident response handbook, and this is something that you won't see unless you have this kind of realistic environment. Yeah, and I think there is much value in that. Like the even not necessarily being prepared for to conducting certain technical tasks, but being prepared to that things will go wrong, if that makes sense, or being prepared to the fact that you will arrive to a situation that's not like, again, in this incident response playbook, but you have to adapt is particularly important. So yeah, so from the Western perspective, and I think success of locked shields also shows that there is both the appetite and both need to coordinate, cooperate to build out those, let's say, common defense or having understanding of how things will look when there is an attack.
Cool. So I think like the only thing like we did mention AI during this podcast, but I guess we don't have
Okay.
time.
Don't do
So
well.
that may be another big
Yeah. You know,
discussion.
this long lasting feud between Kimmel and Matt Damon. You
So yeah, we
know?
will
We
have Matt
need to have a
Damon
feud
next
with AI.
episode.
Yeah. So we didn't have time for Matt Damon, so we will probably invite him for
Yeah.
the next episode. We
Maybe.
didn't have time for AI today, so probably we will mention it next time. Whenever it is. Yeah, I think like jumping into AI would open that can of worms, and we will have to spend at least the same
Another
amount of
podcast.
time on discussing that. But yeah, on that, I think that's enough. That's more than enough. Thank you very much for sharing your perspective, and
Oh, thank you
thank you
very
for
much for
joining
having me.
us.
Yeah, I
And
hope
please
so.
have a lot of fun tomorrow on stage. Share your perspective, share your experience, share your bright insight. And yeah, good luck. Good luck overall
Yeah,
with the talk. Say
thank
hello
you.
to all my hack and everyone
I
there.
will. I will. Thank you very much again. Thank you for having me. I hope the stuff we talked about will be interesting to listeners. It was interesting to you, and I was able to provide some new perspective at least, if not insights on this stuff. And yeah, it was great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Yeah. Okay.